There's few things in life as pleasurable as finding someone who shares your obsession with that book or that movie or that album and just talk over it. That's what this podcast is all about. We're not necessarily experts or professionals, but we are enthusiasts, and that's all that is needed to have a great conversation. This is Entusiastas, and I am Jorge Luis Flores. Hello and welcome to our first ever episode of Entusiastas. The subject of our first episode is going to be a novel, one of the greatest novels ever written. I'm talking about Herman Melville's Moby Dick, or The Whale, first published in 1851. By this time, Melville was a well-known, well-respected, successful writer, thanks to loosely autobiographical novels such as T.P. and Umu, which spoke of his adventures at sea. Moby Dick, although also taking place at sea, was quite another beast and people were not ready for it. We have little more to say in reprobation or in recommendation of this absurd book, a contemporary critic declared after reading the novel. Mr. Melville has to thank himself only if his horrors and his heroics are flung aside by the general reader as so much trash belonging to the worst school of Bedlam literature, since he seems not so much unable to learn as disdainful of learning the craft of an artist. Although today thought of as his masterpiece and one of the greatest works of American literature, Moby Dick was really the beginning of the decline of Melville's career, and he seemed to be aware of what was in store for him. While working on the book, he wrote in a letter to Nathaniel Hawthorne, "What I feel most moved to write, that is banned. It will not pay. Yet, altogether ride the other way, I cannot." After Moby Dick, his works continued to fare progressively worse with both public and criticism, and he died in poverty. He eerily predicted this in the same letter to Hawthorne, "Though I wrote the Gospels in this century, I should die in the gutter." It wasn't until much after his death that a critical reappraisal of his work took place. Today, we can't speak of the history of the novel without speaking of this book, and to speak with me about it, I was joined by Kristin Van Tassel, who teaches writing and American literature at Bethany College in Lindsborg, Kansas. She also writes essays and poetry. I will give the links to some of her writing in the description. Thank you for listening. Welcome, Kristin. Thank you very much for being here.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, this is your favorite novel. Am I right, Kristin?
Yes. I mean, it's my favorite novel is hard to categorize because I love so many. But if I had to, yes, Moby Dick is my favorite. It's at the top of the list.
On my hand, I didn't really have any sort of relationship with Moby Dick until this year. Obviously, I knew of its existence. And like I dare say, most readers, I had managed to avoid actually reading it. And the reason I read it was mainly thanks to you, because I knew it was your favorite book. I also knew that you teach it, and you had recommended it to me, and you have recommended many of the best books I've read in recent years. So I took advantage of the pandemic to finally get to it. And so my first question to you is, when did you first read Moby Dick? Do you remember?
I do. I read Moby Dick for the first time when I was in college one summer, and I was actually just trying to read some long classics that I'd heard about but had never read. So like that same summer, I think I read Anna Karenina, and a few other Russian novels. But the more memorable reading was my second reading of the novel. And that's when I read it in a class in grad school with a professor, Dr. Elizabeth Schultz, who went on to become my PhD advisor. And she loved the book and she was an expert in it. And it brought that book to life for me in ways that I hadn't felt or seen the first time that I read it, when I was doing it entirely on my own. I think that Moby Dick is a book that really is perhaps best when it's read in a community, or read when you have somebody else you can talk with about it.
Yeah, that's interesting. So you say, because the first time you read it, how old were you, you think?
I was probably 20 years old, I think. Yeah.
Okay. So, but that was the first reading. And the second reading was already when you were in college?
It was when I was in my PhD program.
Oh,
and so I was probably 28 or 29 when I read it. Yeah.
So my age, actually. I ask because it has this fame of being, since it's one of the classics, it has this fame of being read in school, in high school or as an assignment. But as it happens with many other classics, like in Spanish, maybe Don Quixote, it really, when you read it, it's very obvious that it shouldn't be assigned to such young readers. And as a teacher, I guess that you have experienced this yourself. I mean, you experienced it first as a student, and now you get to experience it as a teacher. How is the response you get usually from students when you get to teach it?
Well, that's an interesting question, because students, there's actually a fairly broad range of responses to this novel. So some students love it and some quickly do not love it. What's been fairly common is when people find out that I do teach this to college students, they'll tell me stories about it, like these stories of trauma. Like they'll talk about how it was the one class, it was the one book that they were assigned that they didn't finish and that they used, you know, the cliff notes to get through it. Or they'll talk about how they liked the beginning of it and then they just became bewildered and didn't know what to do with it. So they had to abandon it. So I've gotten a lot of stories from other people who have not been my students, sort of complaining about this novel. And I think it's a terrible choice for high schoolers. And lots of times when it is, like, I think that this book was maybe assigned to high schoolers, say 50 years ago, the full book. I think when it's assigned in more recent years, it's been excerpted. And I think that that does very real damage to the book. So people have just kept the action parts and eliminated the more difficult chapters. But my students have a mixed response to it. But what they've also found is that I think that even the students who find it difficult, sometimes they complain that the book makes them feel stupid. When they see like my relentless enthusiasm about it, then to some extent, I think that they keep trying because they can see that I love this book so much. And the way that it is written, it invites you in again and again. The chapters are fairly short, and so it's possible to like make a fresh start with the novel, even when you're halfway into it, just given the way that it's structured and the way that it explores so many things in so many different chapters.
Yeah, and actually, I want to come back to your experience as a teacher later on, but I wanted to comment on the fact that the shock, I guess I would call it that way, the shock that it is to actually read the book, because it's commonly said in reference to these big, iconic pieces of literature that are these books that everyone talks about, but nobody has read.
Right.
And they have permeated culture so much that you can really go your whole life without reading them. And you absorb enough of it to know what it is about just by like a social osmosis. And so I find it very interesting that in one way, these are books that are generally known, but that gives them a quality when you actually go to them that is, it makes them stranger. Let me explain what I'm trying to say. So everyone knows that Moby Dick they know the action, right? They know the overarching plot. Everyone mm-hmm. knows that it's about, mostly they know it's about Ahab. I don't know if everyone knows it, that the narrator is actually someone else and not Ahab, but it's about a mad captain of a whaling ship who lost his leg to a huge, legendary white whale, and he is on a quest to find and kill this whale. Everyone knows that. And there have been movies made about this, and movies tend to only keep the action parts. And so you get the idea that it is an action novel, like an adventure novel. Mm-hmm. But then when you read it, immediately in the first chapter, I would say, you discover that it's so much more. And it almost, really, you discover, and I guess that's what makes it traumatic for many students, for many young people who try to read it, is that the adventure is a very, very small part of it.
Right.
It's really this whole other thing. It's many things at once, and that's one of the things that I found most thrilling about it. It has parts that are like discussions on ethics, discussions on philosophy, discussions on faith. It has a large portion of it dedicated in extreme detail to the trade of whalemen, and it even tries to develop its own taxonomy of whales. And so I guess what I'm trying to say is just that there's a double movement with books that are very well known generally, because you expect the thing that it creates is that you expect one thing and you get another. And so even though you think you know it, you will always be surprised. And if you're introduced to novels like this too young, that surprise is going to probably be negative. But if you are introduced to them in the right moment by the right person, then that surprise is just like a gift.
Absolutely. Like, I think that there's all this sort of cultural, there's this cultural memory and attitudes that can oftentimes get, like, there's the existence of what we think we know about the novel that can get in the way with the actual reading of it. There's this American writer named Walker Percy who wrote an essay called Loss of the Creature, and he describes how oftentimes if you go to a place like the Grand Canyon, like the genuine wonder and astonishment of that place is something that often you cannot reach if you carry with it to it what he calls the symbolic complex, like all these ideas about everything that you've known about the Grand Canyon before you get there, that gets in the way of your experience of the Grand Canyon. So it no longer belongs to you. And I think that the same thing is going on with Moby Dick, that because it is this iconic book in our culture, it carries this symbolic complex that can get in the way of the actual mm-hmm. text and engaging with it.
Actually, this reminds me, I don't know if you've read, there's this book of essays by Italo Calvino, who it's called Why Read the Classics, I think, in English. And he the first couple pages he spends trying to define what a classic is. And he has, I think, 12 characteristics of what a classic is. And one of them is, he says, a classic is a book that even, I'm butchering his words, but he's like, a classic is a book that even when you first read it, it's already a rereading.
Yes. Yeah.
And I think this relates to what you're saying, that you're mm-hmm. even when you first arrive at the book, it's impossible that you have avoided entirely other interpretations and other readings of the book. So when you read it, you're carrying that with you, and that can either affect you in a wrong way or in a good way.
Right, absolutely. And that's like when I teach this, I mean, to relate this back to how I teach it and my students' response to it, partly because of this and partly because the first chapter is so incredibly rich and important, as you pointed out. I lots of times will spend the full first class period just on the opening chapter. And that, I think, helps students. It invites students into the watery depths, so to speak. that I think is really useful, because you can see so much of what's going on in these opening chapter.
Call me Ishmael. Some years ago, never mind how long precisely, having little or no money in my purse and nothing particular to interest me on shore, I thought I would sail about a little and see the watery part of the world. It is a way I have of driving off the spleen and regulating the circulation. Whenever I find myself growing grim about the mouth, whenever it is damp, drizzly November in my soul, whenever I find myself involuntarily pausing before coffin warehouses and bringing up the rear of every funeral I meet, and especially whenever my hippos get such an upper hand of me that it requires a strong moral principle to prevent me from deliberately stepping into the street and methodically knocking people's hats off, then I account it high time to get to sea as soon as I can. This is my substitute for pistol and ball. With a philosophical flourish, Cato throws himself upon his sword. I quietly take to the ship. There is nothing surprising in this. If they but knew it, almost all men in their degree, some time or other, cherished very nearly the same feelings toward the ocean with me.
Like, what surprises did the book give you in this first reading with your teacher? Like, this technically second reading, but this first time that you actually appreciated the book. What surprises, what moments you remember that you felt, oh, this is something else. This is not what I expected.
Well, I think it would definitely be the relationship between Ishmael and Queequeg, and the centrality of Queequeg to this novel, which is a character who is mostly absent, actually, from the cultural mythology that everybody knows, whether they've read it or not. But Ishmael, who is presumably a white American in 19th century, encounters the other, right? So he encounters someone who is so different from him and who is frightening at first because of that. But then that person becomes his friend, and that friendship is incredibly important in lots and lots of ways. Enables Ishmael to think about everything from religion to value systems to stereotypes very differently than he had before. But also Queequeg like saves the life of four people in this book, including Ishmael at the end. So it's like literally this this strange, unusual being who he encounters saves his life in not just a physical way, but also in sort of a psychic and spiritual and emotional way.
I felt a melting in me. No more my splintered heart and maddened hand were turned against the wolfish world. This soothing savage had redeemed it. There he sat, his very indifference speaking a nature in which there lurked no civilized hypocrisies and bland deceits. Wild he was, a very sight of sights to see, yet I began to feel myself mysteriously drawn towards him. And those same things that would have repelled most others, they were the very magnets that thus drew me. I'll try a pagan friend, thought I, since Christian kindness has proved but hollow courtesy.
I think that was also for me the most surprising part of the book in the first pages, the first chapters. And maybe here I should say to people who are listening and who probably haven't read Moby Dick and are just interested in it or So I should maybe explain a little bit. So in the first chapters, we meet Ishmael and as he makes his way to finding a ship that would take him. And he spends the night in an inn that does not have beds available. So he has to share a bed with a harpooner that comes from New Zealand. He's from an indigenous tribe from New Zealand. And so he befriends this character called Queequeg. And really their relationship, it's a very, very unique one. And like many other things in this book, it feels very modern. And I kept thinking of another book I read at the beginning of this year, The Heart of Darkness, and by Conrad, and the contrast between them, because obviously Conrad's book was written later on. But the big difference is that Conrad is not open and doesn't give a voice to difference.
Mm-hmm.
So he sees the cruelty of the colonial endeavor in Africa, but he does not really open his character to trying to understand otherness. And what is very interesting about Melville and Ishmael is that in his first encounter with Queequeg and in subsequent episodes with Queequeg, he's constantly shocked by first by how he looks, then by what he does. For example, there's he shaves every morning using the harpoon, or he eats in the table with the harpoon. He has this small idol that he prays to, and all of these things do shock Ishmael, but he makes us go through his mental struggle in a very logical way until he thinks to himself like, well, actually, if I look at this from this other side, I can see that we're all... So he's constantly discovering things that would be odd about Christianity if looked from out the outside.
Exactly, yes. And to Ishmael's credit, he's open to that.
Yes.
And that's part of what... I mean, Ishmael is probably my favorite narrator in all of literature. And it's partly just because he is receptive to being changed. And it makes it a delightful journey. He's very curious, but then also is willing to think differently about something than he did before. And that's partly what makes the relationship between him and Queequeg possible.
Yes. And it's I think actually this leads me, or is a nice segue into another of the first things that shocked me about the book, is that the first chapters are also very funny.
Yes.
And I wasn't expecting Moby Dick to be a funny book. I mean, it is also very ominous and very tragic. And there's obviously a quality to Ishmael that is disquieting, because he's obviously someone who suffers from some type of depression. That's mm-hmm. how the book starts. He goes wailing, not because he's a fan of wailing, but because every time he feels he's falling into depression, even though he doesn't use those words, he has a longing for the sea. But there's this genuine... long segments from the book that are very, very funny. And his relationship with Queequeg in the first chapters is part of what is most funny about the book, in a way that reminded me of Don Quixote and Sancho Panza.
Okay, yeah, sure.
I don't know if you see a resemblance there, but just this... For example, in the morning when he wakes up and he realizes that Queequeg is holding him.
Right.
And he says that he's holding him very affectionately, almost like if he was his wife.
Right. Or the night before, where like there's all this tension that's built up because Ishmael keeps on asking questions about the harpooner that he's going to be sharing a bed with. And the innkeeper gives him somewhat cryptic answers. And so it's after dark. Ishmael's already asleep when Queequeg arrives to the room, and they both terrify each other. You know, Queequeg doesn't expect to find Ishmael in his bed.
Yeah.
And when Ishmael actually lays eyes on Queequeg for the first time, and he's, you know, tattooed across his body, he jumps up and screams. It's very funny.
But the interval I spent in deliberating what to say was a fatal one. Taking up his tomahawk from the table, he examined the head of it for an instant, and then, holding it to the light with his mouth at the handle, he puffed out great clouds of tobacco smoke. The next moment the light was extinguished, and this wild cannibal, tomahawk between his teeth, sprang into bed with me. I sang out, I could not help it now, and giving a sudden grunt of astonishment, he began feeling me.
Yeah, I just find it so interesting. It feels so ahead of its time. I could see a similar approach today. That's what I'm trying to say. And today it might feel like a writer trying to be woke, but back then it just feels so modern.
Right. I mean, yeah, you've touched on a number of things here. So certainly when Melville's Moby Dick was first released, it was not well received. People were mostly bewildered by it. It was only in the next century that it became known as an important novel and, you know, brought into the academy and that sort of thing as a central text. But it has a lot of really strange characteristics or unusual characteristics, including the relationship between Ishmael and Queequeg, but you know, there are strange sort of stylistic features where one of the chapters reads like a script. Mm-hmm. And there are all these chapters about whales and details about whaling that are very specific but deeply philosophical. And so what you see in this novel is, I think, a couple of things going on that, first of all, it has these sort of postmodern qualities where,
yes,
where like the center of the story has been decentered in various kinds of ways. And one way is through, the relationship between Ishmael and Queequeg. So you have the white male Christian who is decentered in this story very early on because of his relationship with a man who's from an indigenous tribe in what's now New Zealand. But then there's also, you have like these multiple perspectives where Ishmael is trying to capture give voice to other kinds of things, including even like there's a whole chapter that's devoted to the whale's voice, or talks about the whale's voice, and the whale does not have a voice. Mm-hmm. And so Ishmael tries to understand and get at the essence of the whale in all these different ways order to give voice to the whale. But also the novel is dealing with uncertainty in ways that are very postmodern. Like, for example, in the chapter about Queequeg's background called Biographical, very early on it says that Queequeg was a native of Kokovo, and I'm not even sure if I'm pronouncing that right, an island far away to the west and south. And it says, it is not down in any map. True places never are.
Yes, yes, I love that.
And so the place where Queequeg comes from is a place that is beyond what Ishmael is equipped to explain and pinpoint. And so, like, it can't be presented to, you know, like any kind of map presents a particular point of view and an argument almost. Like, this is what this looks like. And so he's disrupting that, or Melville is disrupting that by pointing out that this character who has become, and it goes on to become, a very important character in sort of destabilizing the general assumptions of Ishmael's world. Is something that can't be captured in a map. Yeah. Yeah, yes. that maps are interpretations, right? Mm-hmm, uh-huh. And that this book is dealing so much with how do we interpret our lives as we move through them, and how do those interpretations give meaning to our life? And it has this very fluid relationship with interpretations that was unfamiliar and deeply uncomfortable for readers in the 19th century, I think.
Yes, yes. I think it's a very, and that actually leads us to the main thing that most impressed me about this book, in a very similar way to how Don Quixote impressed me the first time I read it. And that's how modern and even postmodern several parts of it read. And I actually have here, I wanted to share with you, there's an Argentinian writer called, his name is Rodrigo Fresán. He's a big enthusiast of American literature. Most of his criticism I've read is about American authors. And in an interview, he said that his wish would be to write a Moby Dick, because that book seems to me, I'm quoting him, to still be the most modern book there is. Mm-hmm. And he says, he tries to make an analogy with rock music. He says he compares it to the White Album by the Beatles, because he says that in that album, the Beatles have like a song that is punk, a song that is folk, a song that is concrete music, a song that is kind of a Bowie song, a song that even sounds kind of grunge. And so he says, I think that even the most extreme David Foster Wallace,
yes, yeah,
is nothing or has nothing on Moby Dick. He says, in what touches to experimentation, he says, mm-hmm. Moby Dick, it's a book that has, I believe, 25 pages of epigraphs.
Right. He said,
and it's true. And this is the first, this is the thing that leads you into the book. Like, it depends on the right. edition, right. obviously, but mm-hmm. but it has several pages of quotations, and these quotations are mostly from the Bible. There's the Genesis, there's Job, Jonah, Psalms, Isaiah, but also classics like Plutarch, Pliny, there's Montaigne, Rabelais, there's Shakespeare, there's Hobbes, Paradise Lost, but there's also scientific accounts. There's Darwin, and there's also folk songs about whaling. And not content with making like this compilation of references to whales and leviathans, he even has a small preamble to the quotations that might probably be invented, that is supplied by a sub-librarian.
Right, right.
And he writes this small digression about the sub-librarian. And it just, I don't know, it seems that is already very postmodern, because what he's doing is reckoning with all the literature available on whaling. He's starting his book on a whale by listing all the important references to whales before him, and in a way that I don't know if even he was able to foresee. It's funny that Moby Dick became the whale reference in literature. So he managed to overshine even the Bible, I think, because for most people, I think Moby Dick is more iconic in reference to whales, at least, than the Bible. And it has other characteristics. All these, many of these smaller chapters are really meditations, essays, mm-hmm. in various, how to say, registers.
Yes.
And so, yes, it's just such an incredibly, incredibly, incredibly modern, fresh book to read. It feels modern today.
Right. Like the, you were talking about the sub librarian, which is just this great detail. And another part of the humor, actually, you know, it starts by this extract supplied by the sub librarian. And then that whole preliminary section right before, which is like a page and a half, right before the many pages of quotes, is all bracketed. Yeah. And so it's like an aside. So the novel starts with an aside statement, which is just an really interesting choice. It gives you a sense of what it's going to end up being like. But I think that, you know, you asked early on about how do I teach it? And I think that if you acknowledge like the multi-genre nature of this novel and sort of the unusual things that it's doing, which is still new today for students. You know, if you talk about that as you're reading it, then I think that students are more likely to be receptive and open to the novel instead of frustrated with it. Yeah. So that's also helpful. But another interesting thing is that Melville was good friends with Nathaniel Hawthorne, and they had like this correspondence. And right when he finished Moby Dick, he wrote Hawthorne and said, "I've written a wicked book, but I feel clean as a lamb." And so there was this sense that, and I don't think that there's anything going on in this book. Like, I don't think the wickedness has to do with morality. Or the message of the novel, but instead has to do with the way that it's written, because it breaks so many rules of how novels are supposed to work. So
yeah, and he says in one of the letters to Hawthorne, because I read it in some of them in preparation for today, and he says in one, "Shall I send you a fin of the whale by way of a specimen mouthful? The tail is not yet cooked, though the hell fire in which the whole book is broiled might not unreasonably have cooked it all areas. This is the book's motto, the secret one." And he says it's in Latin, but it means something like, "I don't baptize this in name of the Father, but in name of the devil." And so, yeah, it seems like he knew that people wouldn't be ready for this sort of Frankenstein monster of a book. And so actually this, I wanted to ask you, because I don't have the knowledge of what literature was, American literature was at that point. I know that he was a contemporary of many of the people that we think of as the fathers of American literature, right? He lived in the same time as Hawthorne, I think Emerson as well, Poe, maybe. So what I wonder is, I know Hawthorne was a very popular and well-respected author, but maybe you must have a better grasp. I'm very ignorant about that period. How drastically different do you think this book was to what was being written? I, for example, have never even read Hawthorne.
Yeah, I don't know. That's an interesting question, and it's maybe hard to answer quickly. There was a very famous book written in the 1950s that described the mid-19th century as like the American Renaissance of literature, when it was really born. And it was prompted, the author argued that it was prompted by Ralph Waldo Emerson, who was primarily an essayist, but who called for an American poet or an American scholar. And then Melville, Hawthorne, Walt Whitman, who is a poet, and Poe was sort of on the edges. He didn't have a personal relationship with Emerson, but Thoreau, Henry David Thoreau. So those four guys were sort of knew one another, were contemporaries. Hawthorne and Melville were good friends. Whitman was a little bit younger, but they all saw themselves as participating in and responding to Emerson's call, or at least that's what's been argued. And I think that there's definitely evidence for it. Hawthorne, I mean, much of what Hawthorne wrote has sort of a Gothic feel. A lot of his short stories in particular, he had maybe a darker image. Like Emerson is very American in sort of his idealism and his optimism and like unwavering confidence that this is something that can be done. And I think that the men who responded or saw themselves responding to that were doing so with different degrees of optimism. Like Whitman was all in. You know, Whitman is definitely also sort of just this embracing of America. And even though he has this very radical, he proposes a very radical democracy in his poetry, he was all in. Whereas we see with Mel, we see some more hesitation maybe in Hawthorne's portrayal, which is, you know, definitely romantic in terms of style and sensibilities, and then, you know, leaning towards Gothic with a fair amount of what he writes. Mm-hmm. But Melville was has a much darker worldview in certain respects, and doesn't have that confidence or optimism about America that Emerson promotes. And that is really evident in this novel. It's evident in some of his short stories and other work too, but that doubt, the doubt and questions about American possibilities are very present in this novel.
Yeah, that's very interesting now you say it, because I hadn't thought of a comparison to Walt Whitman, maybe just because it's poetry and this is narrative. But would you say it's a fair, it's fair to say that maybe you could read the poetry of Walt Whitman and the late narrative from Moby Dick on of Melville as sort of the both sides of the coin of the American project? Because Whitman was, they are both pretty mystical, but Whitman is a force of, I don't know how to say it, of unbridled joy and hope, I don't know how, unity. And on the other side, Melville is, there's always an ominous tone. It's like Whitman was seeing towards the side where the sun was rising, and Melville was watching to the other side of the sky where a huge storm was coming. Would you say that would be fair to say, or am I just saying?
No. I think that would be very fair to say that. I don't know. Are spoilers okay in this talk? Or
yes, I think so. I think it's spoilers are okay, because I think, and I want to say that also to people who are thinking about reading Moby Dick, the joy of reading Moby Dick does not come from the surprises of the plot, because I think most people know how it ends. I think the joy of reading Moby Dick is in the surprises of just the quality of the prose. I mean, all the surprises we have been speaking of right now. So, yes,
okay.
Spoilers are okay.
While I had just assumed that everyone knew how the story ended, because it is such an iconic story. And one time when I was teaching it, one semester when I was teaching it, I referred to the ending, you know, when we were halfway through, my students got really mad.
So spoiler alert. If you don't want to get the book spoiled, then maybe you should stop listening here, read the book, and come back.
I think I can answer your question if it's okay to give away the ending.
Yes, yes, of course.
And so, right, like one thing that happens in Moby Dick is that we are introduced to the crew. We're introduced to Queequeg and Ishmael and their relationship, but then they join the Pequod, you know, they enlist to serve on the Pequod. And the ship is this incredibly diverse place. And like there are sailors from across the world. What's really, really interesting is that there's the captain. In the ship's hierarchy, there's the captain at the top, and then there are the three mates. And all of those mates are white American men. So the first mate, second mate, third mate. But then the harpooners are the next in the hierarchy. And so they're at the top of the crew in terms of the hierarchy. So they have the most power, they earn the most money, they get the biggest percentage of the take. So this is on a whale ship. And so Queequeg is a harpooner, and the other two harpooners are, well, one harpooner, Tashtego, is a Native American or American Indian, indigenous from a tribe in what's now the United States. Then the third harpooner is a Black African who had never been enslaved. So he, you know, he became a whaler as a free African from Africa. Mm-hmm. And so you have at the top of the crew hierarchy these three men who, part of the reason why they're so important is because they're the most skilled people on the ship. And so they have these important skills. So they're like just these incredibly athletic, capable, skilled men who are not white Americans. And then you have the rest of the crew that comes from all over the world. And that's conveyed actually in the chapter that reads like a script because it describes each man by where he's from, and they come from all over. So you see this ship that is incredibly diverse and is in control by this man, this white man, this old white man who is not mentally unwell. And the ship then becomes like this, almost like a metaphor for the United States, right? And this was published right before the Civil War. So there was a lot of uncertainty. There was deep division in the United States at the time. People were not sure what was going to happen. There was the possibility that things were going to fall apart. And so you see, to some extent, I would argue that you see Melville exploring democracy via this ship. And there's this balance of power where autocracy is a problem, but anarchy is also a problem because they depend on one another so much in order to survive and in order to get the whales. And the ship goes down at the end, right? And there's one survivor. It's Ishmael, and he survives because of Queequeg's coffin, which is a whole chapter devoted to that, why Queequeg had a coffin built. At one point, he thought he was going to die, and then he decides he's not going to. He thought he was sick and that he's something he needed to do, and so he recovered, which is actually sort of this interesting, you know, detail that feels very American, that if we just make up our mind to do something, then it comes to be. But that coffin remains as a life buoy on the ship. They decide to keep it as a life buoy, and that's what saves Ishmael's life. And he's the person then who tells this story. So if you contrast Walt Whitman's incredibly, equally inclusive democracy, you know, so he includes all kinds of characters and Americans in his most famous, very long poem, Song of Myself. But if you place that alongside Moby Dick, where you see both men exploring the fairly new American experience, which was in a time of crisis when they were writing, you see very different endings or very different conclusions or projections for how this might go.
Yes, I don't know. I mean, there's obviously been thousands is maybe too much, but many, many different interpretations of what Moby Dick stands for. And the problem also with Melville is that, from what I understand, he burnt a lot of his own like personal writings. And so it's difficult to tell what he really believed Moby Dick was about. In one letter to Hawthorne, when responding to Hawthorne's praise of the book, he says something like he's very happy because Hawthorne got the book, like he understood what the book was about, even though he disliked some of the structure of the novel and so on. But on the other hand, when he wrote a letter to Hawthorne's wife, he corrects her. he appreciates her reading of the book, but he very clearly says that he did not intend the book to be read as an allegory for anything. So do you think he was just bluffing? Do you think that he was, I mean, it's hard to believe he was being sincere when the book is obviously so complex and so many references are made to faith, philosophy. I mean, do you think he was being earnest when he said that he didn't intend it to be read as allegorically?
I think that's probably possible, partly because allegories are also too simple. You know, like when we read something like Pilgrim's Progress or something like that. Like they're too didactic and simple allegories are. And I think that Melville was definitely aiming for something that was more complex. I also think though that, you know, a book can take on that it's possible to create something that you didn't fully recognize understand as you were creating it. And then it, once it, you know, it enters the world, it becomes a life of its own and becomes a creature in and of itself. And then it belongs to everybody so that it doesn't really matter what Melville thought he was writing. And, you know, part of what makes this text really rich is that it can be reasonably interpreted in many, many ways. And one could very persuasively argue that it's about many, many different kinds of things. And people have often applied this novel to their particular historical moment. So like in the 50s, when this novel became really, really popular as an important canonical text, you know, it was read, Ahab was read, or the whale, depending on your choice, or read as, you know, Nazi Germany or Hitler or something like that. But I think that that's okay. In other words, like, of course, there's no way that Melville was right. You know, we look at this. No, Melville was not writing about Nazi Germany. but that's still, it's okay for us to read this book as revealing something really important about our own historical moment and the way that humans react and conduct themselves in certain kinds of situations.
Yeah.
And so then I as an American literature, a person who's spent a lot of time with American literature and teaches it, I am especially interested in what this novel and novels and work that was produced at the time that Melville was writing, what that reflects about the American experience. But I also acknowledge that that definitely reflects the fact that I'm an American and that this is what I've spent a lot of time studying and thinking about. So,
yeah, and I agree totally with you. I think that that's also a necessary characteristic of true classics. That's what keeps them alive and what makes them always come back. You know, even some books that kind of disappear for a while and they come back with a renewed strength. I think that we shouldn't, I mean, and this is not an original thought. This is this has been said by many people, but yeah, books are not the author's property. Interpretation, though you cannot interpret just anything you like, it has to actually come from the book. Part of what enriches a book is its relationship, both with each reader, but also with each new context in which is read. Actually, relating to your comment about you related to what it means being American, I don't know if you've read an essay by Toni Morrison, another writer that I know thanks to you. I just read part of an essay about whiteness in American literature. And she makes this very convincing case for the whale, for Moby Dick representing whiteness as ideology, she says. Like that's right during the Civil War. During that time, she says that whiteness became an ideology. And she says that that probably was part of the reason why the book was so poorly received and not well understood in his time. And she says, to question the very notion of white progress, the very idea of racial superiority, of whiteness as a privileged place in the evolutionary ladder of humankind, and to meditate on the fraudulent, self-destroying philosophy of that superiority, that was dangerous, solitary, radical work, especially then, especially now. And I mean, and that goes to show just what you were saying. Me not being an American, not having grown in America with the particular social conditions of the United States, I hadn't thought, it hadn't occurred to me to think of that, but there is this whole, one of the most brilliant chapters of the book that is called On the Whiteness of the Whale.
Right.
in which Melville he really dissects all the possible meanings of whiteness and how whiteness, yes, it stands usually for purity and all of this stuff, but it also can make things very frightening.
Aside from those more obvious considerations touching Moby Dick, which could not but occasionally awaken in any man's soul some alarm, there was another thought, or rather vague, nameless horror concerning him, which at times by its intensity completely overpowered all the rest, and yet so mystical and well-nigh ineffable was it that I almost despair of putting it in a comprehensible form. It was the wideness of the whale that above all things appalled me. But how can I hope to explain myself here, and yet, in some dim random way, explain myself I must, else all these chapters might be naught.
Right, exactly. So it's this very different take on whiteness, where he starts with, here's what we say, here's our assumptions about whiteness, and this is narrated through Ishmael, but it ends with whiteness being terrifying. And it's terrifying because it represents all that we cannot know. Like, okay, I'm looking it up right now here because it seems like it's an important statement. He talks about how he calls it the dumb blankness mm-hmm. of whiteness is full of meaning, and that it presents this possibility that we do not understand what we think that we understand. And that whiteness is not necessarily all that it's cracked up to be. Yeah, it's a really interesting subversion of the color white. And yeah. I'm familiar with Morrison's reading of it. I think, was that from her collection, Playing with the Dark, maybe?
I don't know. I actually found it. I mean, the version in which I found it was apparently from a lecture she gave. It's called the Tanner Lectures. Yes, probably it was later compiled into a whole book.
Okay. And right. I think that's a very persuasive reading of this, and why this book, that people recognize it as subversive in ways that frightened them.
Yes. And I also loved about her take on it. And she says that the whole of the canon, let's say, of American literature should be reread by Black critics. And she's not saying it, and she's very specific about it, that she's not saying it like this is the correct and only reading of the book. She's mm-hmm. more arguing for a greater richness of interpretation, which I found very... Yes, it certainly enriches it, because like I said, I hadn't thought of it that way. I originally asked you if it would be a good idea to read Moby Dick in the horrible 2020. And I told you that I was dealing with many fears about the future, as I'm sure many people are. And like not knowing if there was purpose in life. And for me, the reading of the book was mainly anchored by that. And there are also extracts of the book, passages in the book where Ishmael wonders about the meaninglessness of life, the contrast of beauty and horror. There's this great episode where they stumble with a, I don't know how to call it, a colony of whales, and they get to the center, and there's this very tender moment of mother whales feeding their children, and it's interrupted by this horribly violent situation where a whale is accidentally killing other whales. Mm-hmm. And so I read it more from that perspective, and I know that you have to go very soon, so I just wanted to share with you another reading from Roberto Bolaño. He compares Moby Dick with The Adventures of Huckleberry Finn.
Mm-hmm.
And he says, all American novelists, including those who write in Spanish, at some point get a glimpse of two books looming on the horizon. These books represent two paths, two structures, and above all, two plots, even sometimes two fates. One is Moby Dick, and the other is The Adventures of Huckleberry Finn. The first is the key to those realms that, by convention or for the sake of convenience, we call the realms of evil, those places where man struggles with himself and with the unknown and is generally defeated in the end. The second is the key to adventure and happiness, a lesser known land, modest and unassuming, in which the character or characters set the quotidian in motion, started rolling, and the results are unpredictable and at the same time recognizable and close at hand. And he then says, why, what was Melville trying to tell us? This is an enigma that has yet to be solved, because Melville is an enigma and also a writer of greater depth than Twain.
Right. Yeah, I think there's no comparison between the two novels. Yeah, I think that, that Moby Dick is so much better than Huckleberry Finn in lots and lots of ways. So.
Yeah, and I think Bolaño was he tended to do these things. I think he really got pleasure out of making outlandish comparisons that no one else would make, or making sweeping arguments and then probably in another essay saying the opposite thing. But I think here what he's saying is, like, these are two paths in literature. You have your literature or at least novels that lead with unsolvable questions, depressing big issues, and you have your novels that are not necessarily light or unimportant, but they are maybe more on the side of the joy of living. I don't know.
I mean, I think that Twain stops short, like this book, his book becomes something more than maybe it started out being. And once he realizes that, he backs away from it and lets readers off the hook and lets himself off the hook and lets his character off the hook. And Melville doesn't. Like, he takes us with him and takes himself to the conclusion, the necessary conclusion of the novel, rather than suddenly making it something different so that we don't have to face the consequences of what the book has become.
He looked like a man cut away from the stake when the fire has overrunningly wasted all the limbs without consuming them, or taking away one particle from their compacted aged robustness. His whole high, broad form seemed made of solid bronze and shaped in an unalterable mold like Cellini's cast Perseus. Threading its way out from among his gray hairs and continuing right down one side of his tawny, scorched face and neck till it disappeared in his clothing, you saw a slender, rod-like mark, lividly whitish. It resembled that perpendicular seam sometimes made in the straight, lofty trunk of a gray tree, when the upper lightning tearingly darts down it and without wrenching a single twig, peels and grooves out the bark from top to bottom, air running off into the soil, leaving the tree still greenly alive, but branded. I was struck with the singular posture he maintained. Upon each side of the Pequot's quarter deck, and pretty close to the mise and shrouds, there was an auger hole, bored about half an inch or so into the plank. His bone leg steadied in that hole, one arm elevated and holding by a shroud. Captain Ahab stood erect, looking straight out beyond the ship's ever-pitching prow. There was an infinity of firmest fortitude, a determinate, unsurrenderable willfulness in that fixed and fearless forward dedication of the glance. Not a word he spoke, nor did his officers say aught to him, though by all their minutest gestures and expressions, they plainly showed the uneasy, if not painful, consciousness of being under a troubled master eye. And not only that, but Moody Streak and Ahab stood before them with a crucifixion in his face, in all the nameless, regal, overbearing dignity of some mighty woe.
So, Now that we have dealt with interpretations, there's more things about the book that I would love to talk about. There's more characters. I love Starbucks' relationship with Ahab and how it changes throughout the novel. I love the character of Pip, but I guess we could talk forever about this book. So now I'm going to skip that and leave that pleasure to the readers. And I just wanted to ask you, finally, you went full circle, let's say, in your relationship with Moby Dick, and not a lot of people get that chance with the things they love and appreciate, in the sense that you started your relationship as a student with a professor who really showed you and helped you navigate the very hard sea that is Moby Dick. And now you are yourself a professor helping other students navigate the same waters. So how do these experiences differ, and how does one feed the other?
That's a hard question, but that's a good one. I think that the act of reading it, the novel, as a teacher and as a student, enables this rereading and ongoing discovery. So, for example, when I studied this novel with Beth Schultz, she helped me see so much more in it that I hadn't seen the first time through. And each time I teach it, the same thing happens. And I think it's because, like, this teaching this novel has helped me see even more how much it contains, how it contains things that continue to that speak to me differently at different times. So, you know, you mentioned in the opening chapter that Ishmael says he goes to sea when he becomes damp and drizzly, when his soul becomes a damp, drizzly November. That's when he goes to sea, and that going to sea is his substitute for a pistol and ball. And so he clearly suffers from chronic depression, and I can see that now so much more in this novel as a result of teaching it. That issue figures a lot more prominently for me. But there are also, I mean, a lot of my work has also been in studying like environmental literature. So reading this book with my students who are often deeply confused by how Ishmael can be a whaler of these creatures that he loves so much. So in other words, he's in the business of killing whales for profit. And I think that that contradiction is very, very evident to students now who are living with this higher awareness of sort of environmental balance and destruction of the world. And so that's been partly a result of like my own academic work and what I was studying with Beth Schultz in addition to this novel, but also something that has become bigger for me because of my students' reactions to this novel in, you know, the early 21st century. I didn't teach it until the 21st century. And there's also something about reading this book that's very humbling. So, like, I never feel like I'm an expert. And there are so many questions about this novel that I can't answer, or I can only answer in partial or preliminary ways. And I think that that's sort of at the heart of teaching ultimately too, that we're just, maybe teachers are ultimately, or a teacher like me, we're ultimately just enthusiasts, right? And we're inviting people to join us in exploration. And that's part of why I chose this job. And Moby Dick reminds me of that every time I teach it. You know, there are other parts of my job where I feel much more strongly that I am the instructor who is guiding students in certain kinds of skills. But with this novel, I feel like I'm more, it's like this more participatory reading experience where I'm learning and encountering once again this story that's exploring life in all its uncertainty and some of the most wonderful parts about it, like friendship, as well as the most frightening parts of it too. So
I think that teaching a book you love or teaching about things you love is a way of keeping that love alive and also revitalizing experience for the self.
It has to be sort of a lifelong task, right?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. You know, I keep on rereading this novel and finding more and more and more that's worth talking and thinking about and more questions. Ishmael makes this really interesting comment periodically. You know, he's trying to figure out the world of whales and he can't answer all his questions, but he keeps on making these statements. Let us try. You know, so he's trying, like, that's what he says in the chapter, The Whiteness of the Whale. He says, let us try to figure out white whale had such a pull on the mm-hmm. captain, mm-hmm. Ahab, and then the rest of the crew who goes along with him in his pursuit of it. But throughout the novel, Ishmael says, I will try all things. He makes a statement, I will try all things. I achieve what I can.
Yes, yes.
It's like this constant pursuit, really, of trying to figure things out. And this book invites that and allows it.
Well, thank you. Thank you very much, Kristen, for coming. Well, being here in this call, for being my first ever guest. And I think this is a great start for what Entusiastas or Enthusiasts is, because like you said, it's a lifelong task or work. I think that those things that we truly love, be it a book, an album, a movie, these are not just one episode in our lives, but they truly become, if they have touched us in a special way, they become a relationship. We really form relationships with this kind of things. And this is what this podcast will try to explore and celebrate. And so thank you very much for helping me give it a good start.
Well, thanks so much for the invitation, Jorge. It was such a pleasure to talk about this novel, but particularly with you. So thanks.
Thank you very much, Kristen. And I hope that you will be a returning guest. So I don't say like a definitive goodbye, but see you or talk to you later.
Okay.
Have a nice day.
This episode of Entusiastas was hosted by me, Jorge Luis Flores. The episode was mixed by Carlos Hernandez. Original music by Carlos Hernandez and Vera Pedro. Special thanks to Kristen Van Tassel. Check the Entusiastas official site at letreraria.com for additional material and follow us on Facebook, Entusiastas Pod. Thank you for listening and until next episode.